I'd like to say that Colin has already summed up today's lesson. If you don't get anything else, he mentioned the fact that love and forgiveness were at the core of what God did for us, and that's really the summation of the message today as we look at Joseph's life. The last time we were together and talking about Joseph's life, the famine had grown so harsh that in a move of desperation, Joseph had sent his sons back to Egypt for more food, with his precious son Benjamin among them. Israel had prayed that El Shaddai, that is God Almighty, would grant his sons mercy at the hands of this Egyptian vizier, unaware that it was his own son who held their fate. We saw Reuben offer his own sons' lives if harm befell Israel's favorite one, Benjamin. And yet that was not enough. It took the intercession of Judah to personally bear the shame and be like a lost one if Benjamin did not return to gain Israel's reluctant agreement for Benjamin to go. And that only because the state of their food supply was so dire that it was threatening the entire family. Once in Egypt, Joseph commands his brothers to his house. They are beyond intimidated. They remember the money that was returned in their sacks. In a strange turn of events, though, it's a feast, not a repercussion, that the brothers are to take part in. And they are seated in their age order. Was this a sign of his powers of divination? The brothers were certainly amazed. He gave Benjamin 5 times what the others received. And they partied from abject fear of this great man to drunken revelry. What a turn of events. No wonder they were so amazed. And we see the ice in Joseph's veins slowly melting, but not enough for him to free them from the guilt of that long ago event. We're going to pick up the story in Genesis chapter 44, if you'd like to turn in your Bibles. And the story is once again under Joseph's command. Fill the sacks to the max. Be overly generous and return their money. But most importantly, put my divining cup in the sack of the youngest. Once more, Joseph must test these men. Will they stand by Benjamin or leave him to face the consequences alone? Joseph is still the schemer. After he sends them off with their booby-trapped grain, he sends his steward after them at high speed to discover their treachery. You've done evil, the man accuses. In verse 7 of chapter 44, they plead their situation. But we returned the money we found last time. Why would we steal from you now? And with a new case of foot and mouth disease, remember when their father was wringing his hands when they recounted how the man had worked out of them that they had a younger brother? It was that indiscretion that had forced Jacob to send Benjamin with them at all. Now, once again, they blurt out what a more level-headed man would have avoided. The one who has the cup must die, and the rest of us will be your slaves. I think if it had been me, I'd have checked my baggage before I left, and certainly before I put one of my brother's lives on oath. Stuart takes them up on the offer. So shall it be. You've set your own punishment if you're guilty. He searches bag by bag from oldest to youngest and finds, of course, in Benjamin's bag, the silver cup. They tear their clothes in anguish, They're distraught. But finally, they do the right thing. They refuse to abandon Benjamin. What happened with Joseph cannot happen to Benjamin, even if only for the sake of their father, who would be crushed. But it seems to me there's more than that to it. They are answering their father's call for mercy from God with selflessness on Benjamin's behalf. God is moving in this family. So they return to the Egyptian. And as we mentioned last time, Judah is stepping to the fore as the new generation takes over. He begins to show depths we have never seen before. He throws all of them together on the mercy of the Egyptian because he says, God has uncovered our guilt. Now, wait a minute. They're not guilty of anything in relation to the grain. As they had pled with the man, they had returned the money the first time. And we know that it's Joseph that planted the evidence. So what is it that Judah is saying that God has found out their guilt over? And to answer that, we need to go back a few chapters. To a chapter we actually skipped over because it didn't really seem to be part of our story. Some people have even claimed that it's just thrown in there and doesn't really belong. But God's never needed to fill a publisher's word count. Everything is there for a reason. So turn back to chapter 38. This is the old Judah, the one who would profit by selling his brother as a slave. We know this story. His eldest son is evil, and God calls for his death in punishment. The second son, angered that he needs to father a child for his brother, rebels by not providing the seed that would father a child. At least in part, it appears that's because the child would inherit the family title, and he too was condemned to death. The widow Tamar was promised the third son when he grew of age. But when his son reached adulthood, Judah never carried through with the promise. So it was that Judah met a prostitute who contrived to gain his seal, his cord, and his staff as a pledge for payment. And sometime later, Tamar was found to be pregnant by prostitution, Judah's told. He pronounces that she should die for her sin, but she sent the pledge with the report that the man that these belonged to was the father of the child. Only at that point did Judah recognize it was his own sin that had created this situation. In verse 26 of chapter 38, he says, "She is more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her to my son Shelah." This old Judah was so far removed from the laws of God, he forced Tamar to act as a prostitute and couple with her own father-in-law to honor succession. Only when caught did Judah recognize his own sin. So keep this old Judah in mind as we return back to chapter 44. The Judah of chapter 44 has learned a lesson. The need to be righteous triumphs any need to fight the charges the Egyptians have against them, because it is God who has uncovered their sin. Their sin so long ago against Joseph. Just as surely as Tamar uncovered his sin against her, God has worked to the point where Judah now sees his own sin even before it's out in the open. And this time, he's ready to act to right a wrong. They will all be slaves to the man. Judah had promised his father he would bear the shame, but now he sees they must all bear it. None of the other brothers argue. They too are beginning to see their own culpability. None, that is, except the hidden one. Joseph, the grand vizier, says, "No, only the one who was found with a cup will remain. The rest may go back to their father in peace." Seems like a reasonable kind of conclusion, but where does that leave the brothers, and where does that leave Judah? Now the text says, Judah drew near. The word, according to Chuck Swindoll, means not just physically near, but ready for a serious discussion. We might call it a heart-to-heart. And emotional it is. It's the longest speech by any human in Genesis. Judah mentions his father no less than 14 times. He begins by praising the great man in front of him that he is like Pharaoh himself. And then he appeals to the man's familial instincts. Do you have a father or a brother? We have an aged father who has a young son. That son's brother is dead, and he is the only son left of his mother, and his father loves him. What impassioned words. When we read it, we can feel the pathos. Imagine how it must have impacted on Joseph. He was the one, after all, that Judah's talking about. Judah goes on to relate how Israel mourned a son torn apart by wild animals, how he would go to his grave in sorrow if Benjamin was lost to him. The life of the old man is bound up in this son. If we return without him, our father will die. And not only that, I have pledged myself to guarantee the boy's return. So please, let me stay as a slave in his place. How can I face my father and his misery should I go back without Benjamin? How ironic. Judah had been the one to sell Joseph as a slave. Yet here and now he offers to himself become a slave to ransom back Rachel's other son, Benjamin. I can only imagine this was the tipping point for Joseph. We now catch up with our reading today from chapter 45. Joseph is so out of control of his emotion that he cries out for everyone else to leave. And now he stands alone with his brothers. But he weeps in such anguish, the Egyptians outside the door hear his cries. And then the bombshell, "I am Joseph." In Hebrew, in their own language. Is my father still alive? The brothers are dumbstruck. Have you ever had that combined feeling of terror and dismay? When you cannot act at all? When you hold a child with the wind knocked out of them, desperately trying to catch a breath? When you first heard the towers in New York had been destroyed? I think that's how the brothers felt. This Egyptian is claiming to be our brother. I am Joseph. But how else did he speak Hebrew? How else did he know who they were from oldest to youngest? How else did he raise up that name from the past? And now Joseph reaches out in kindness. He uses the same word that described Judah moving close for a heart-to-heart. Come here. Now more softly he repeats that he is Joseph. He understands their guilt. I'm the brother that you sold into Egypt. I know your secret. That the one your father thinks was killed by wild animals was in fact betrayed by his own brothers. But now I'm letting you shed that guilt. God had something better planned. God sent me to save you. There have been 2 years of famine. 5 more are to follow. God sent me here to preserve a remnant for you. In fact, a remnant for God. 3 times he tells them, you're not to blame. With a deflating of the emotion and anger, he has forgiven them. In essence, he tells them, we were all part of God's tapestry that he was weaving through time. He made me an advisor to Pharaoh, even a father figure and ruler over all of Egypt, just so that he could rescue our family. So what are you waiting for? Go! Tell my father. Bring him back as soon as you can. I will provide for you. There are 5 more years of famine. I want to help you. He breaks down again when he embraces Benjamin. And then he embraces each of the others. Pharaoh's servants again hear it, and they ride the wave of relief. In fact, the message goes to Pharaoh, and he too is delighted, so much so that not only provisions are sent, but Pharaoh ordered wagons to bring the family back to Egypt. And they didn't even need to bring their goods, he said. He would provide the best location and goods for them. They were given new clothes, and once again, Benjamin was given far more, along with silver, because he had been ransomed and rescued. Finally, when they're ready to go, Joseph sends the brothers away with one small demand. Don't fight on the way. He knew them, didn't he? Siblings always find ways to provoke each other. He knew it would be so as they went. Perhaps it was that despite the wonderful outcome, they still agitated over telling the father the truth after all this time. As for Jacob, when they returned to him and told him the news that Joseph was alive and was ruler over all Egypt, he had a heart-stopping moment. He refused to believe it. Long ago, he had believed the lie. Now he refuses to believe the truth. It doesn't seem like he'll even believe Benjamin. Only the physical presence of the wagons ready to take them back to Egypt convinces him. I can see him finally believing. It's said in the book that his spirit revived. For the last several weeks or months, since watching Benjamin go, he had been in sorrow. For more than half a year, he had mourned the loss of Simeon. And that was only a small reminder of the greater pain of more than 2 decades of the loss of Joseph. Like so many things in our lives, this long, complicated, and painful journey of Israel's life needed only one more thing to bring it joy: to be reunited with his son so that his family might be reconciled. It is enough, he says. I will go to him before I die. Well, what should we take out of this story for our lives today and each day? I'm going to suggest 3 actors in this story and one whose story was already written but had not been put to parchment that we can learn from. Firstly, Judah. He was a hard man. His attitude was that he would get what he wanted on his terms. He would get the slave price out of his brother as if he was a commodity. He would see his family's line continued, but then he didn't carry it through. He would have a prostitute. But finally, when faced with the evidence of his duplicity, he recognized his daughter-in-law as the righteous one. That began his transformation, such that here he has offered himself up in Benjamin's place, his life for his brothers. His offer never needed to be carried out. But years later, a descendant of his would carry through on the offer of his life for each of us. Jesus became a slave to sin in order to free us once and for all. God accepted that offer on our behalf because his was a gift without blemish. Let's learn from Judah's growth. Let's learn to accept Jesus' gift. Since we have been set free, let us live in freedom. Next, we have Joseph. He wrestled with retaliation and revenge. But when the brothers rallied around Benjamin, and more importantly, when Judah offered to take Benjamin's place, his heart melted. All that he put them through was all contrived to test these men. But when put to that test, they passed. And Joseph recognized a greater cause at work. It was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. These are among the most powerful words of Joseph's story. How should that play out in our lives? Judah and Jesus teach us that we have been freed. Joseph teaches us that we are empowered to free others. That even if God's hand is unseen, he is working his salvation. That we need to see his purposes in all that we do. And finally, of course, there is God. He sends the rain on the just and the unjust. He wants us to follow him as his children. He wants that we should look to him for our nourishment. Not just the kind the rain brings, although he provides it, but our soul refreshing nourishment. But we have a problem. We tend to be horizontally oriented people. We see each other across rooms, across countries, and across the world as simply human. In fact, the world thinks and teaches that's the epitome of what we are, that humanism is our greatest achievement. But as Christians, we know that the vertical is more important than the horizontal. Or should I say that it comes before the horizontal? I'm always moved by pictures taken from the tops of tall buildings or from great peaks that look down on cities or landscapes. The view from above is different and somehow more sweeping than from ground level. God views us from above. He wants us to be part of his story. We are all part of the tapestry that God is weaving through time. He will work with whatever we give him, but he'd rather do it with hearts that are bound up in him. Jesus says the greatest commandment is to love God. We need to have a vertical view of things. But Jesus doesn't leave it there. Just like Jacob's love for Benjamin, just like God's love for us, the first commandment really doesn't exist on its own. If we love God, we will love our neighbor. This week, love God with all your heart, and you'll have more than enough overflow for the people around you.